this is session, we're going to discuss retrieving sperm from azoospermic patients, which is an important issue for many of us dealing with fertility. Okay. And we're going to look at what's medically available, and I will give the halakhic side. We're very honored and happy to have a regular contributor to our conferences, my good friend Professor Goldstein, who is, you have his bio in front of you, but is the head of urology in Cornell.
Male infertility.
Sorry, they call it male infertility. Dr.
Schlegel's the head of urology.
Okay. Dr. Goldstein is also has done a lot of work in Israel, a lot of work with the Jewish community. He's also a very good personal friend. I've spoken at their center, and he's spoken at our conferences, and is always available to come and to help couples in our community who are experiencing these issues. And also I want to personally thank him, because he stepped in at almost the last minute, because the previous speaker unfortunately had a personal conflict, was able to come, his mother died, and so we also appreciated that Professor Goldstein is willing to come and to share his wisdom. We're going to hear from you now.
Yes.
Thank you.
Finding sperm in azoospermic patients is the focus here. But before we get to that, the success of doing that and what you do when you find sperm is very dependent on a collaborative effort. It's a collaborative effort between reproductive urologists like myself and my former student and fellow Dr. Schlegel, who specializes in that, reproductive endocrinologists, because when we find sperm in azoospermic patients, in cases where there's a problem with production, we're almost never able to achieve success in having a child with the man's sperm without the help of reproductive endocrinologists. It almost always requires IVF, and it always requires the kind of IVF where we inject sperm into the egg. Normally, in a man's ejaculate, there's over 100 million sperm. And typically to achieve pregnancies naturally without IVF, without IUI, you'd need a minimum of say 15 million sperm to have enough sperm to do intrauterine insemination, where you simply shoot it inside the uterus. Requires a minimum of 500,000, preferably reproductive endocrinologists prefer 5 million. But when we retrieve sperm in men who have a production problem, by digging it out of the testicles or doing things to get a few sperm into the ejaculate, we literally end up often with only a handful of sperm. And in those situations, even ordinary IVF doesn't work. With ordinary IVF, without ICSI, we take the eggs after they've been retrieved by the reproductive IVF doctor, put them in a petri dish, and then throw 500,000 sperm in. When we have only a handful, there's not enough sperm to do that. So the sperm have to be physically injected by a special technician who injects a single sperm using a high-power microscope and a robotic setup to inject one sperm into each egg. Therefore, with this technique, all we need is preferably a minimum of one live sperm for each egg. So instead of 100 million or 15 million or 5 million or 500,000, if a woman has 10 eggs, all we need is 10 live sperm. There are several ways to potentially achieve that. When I first started in this field 32 years ago, men with this situation, all we could offer them was donor sperm or adoption. Then ordinary IVF came along, and we were able to help a few more. The dramatic transformation came with the introduction of IVF with ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection. That was developed by Dr. Jean-Pierre Palermo in Belgium, who was trying to insert a sperm under the coating of the egg, something called subzonal insertion, and he accidentally put the sperm right into the egg. Other technicians and other scientists had done that, and they immediately discarded the egg because they assumed it would kill the egg, and that's no good. But Dr. Palermo thoughtfully said, well, let me see what happens. And lo and behold, it fertilized. And that's how ICSI was born. And then we recruited Dr. Palermo from Belgium about 18 years ago, and he's been the director of our ICSI program ever since. And that's what dramatically changed the ability to treat even severe male factor. But that still requires obtaining sperm. So in men who have no sperm on their semen analysis, the first thing we have to do is find out what the cause is. There are many causes of azoospermia, which means a zero sperm count, that are potentially treatable. Some of them actually will allow couples to go on and conceive naturally. Some will increase, techniques will increase the sperm count enough to make intrauterine insemination, the much simpler and easier procedure for the couple and less costly than IVF. Some of them will allow ordinary IVF. And finally, the most severe cases, it requires IVF with ICSI using ejaculated sperm. And in the most severe cases, where no sperm appear in the ejaculate, regardless of the treatment that we're able to provide, we have to actually physically open up the testicle, like splitting an egg in half, look under a high-power microscope, and we can identify, not sperm, the operating microscope we use provides 25-power magnification. To identify a sperm, which if you're familiar with the metric system is 6 microns in diameter, that's about the length, the head is about the length of a red blood cell, so you need a 400-power microscope for that. So we can't see sperm under the operating microscope. But what we found is that those tubules, there are 400 to 500 tubules in the testicle, about a quarter of a mile long in each testicle. Those tubules that are making sperm are thicker and larger than the ones that don't. And this is what my student Dr. Schlegel discovered. It took me some time when Dr. Schlegel became my fellow to convince him to use an operating microscope for doing testicle biopsies. Testicle biopsies is when we take a piece of testicle and look at it under a microscope. And in those days, over 20 years ago, we used a biopsy to distinguish between the two causes of a zero sperm count. It could be that you're making sperm normally, but the sperm can't get out. That's called obstructive azoospermia. And that's what we always hope for, because when there's a blockage, sperm production is normal. And then we can either, in a majority of men, I can fix that, I specialize in repairing blockages, or if it's not fixable because they're born without any ducts but they're still making sperm, we can go in and suck sperm out of a little bit of duct that's still present. That's in men who have congenital bilateral absence of the vas deferens, which we've discovered is a mild form of cystic fibrosis. So blockages is what I always hope for. A blockage could be from hernia operations as a child. I specialize in fixing those and wrote several papers about microsurgical repair of iatrogenic, meaning caused by doctors, injuries to the vas deferens from hernia repairs, injuries to the duct of the epididymis, the 15-foot-long duct where sperm learn to swim, that often occur from hydrocoelectomies. And when it's a blockage, we can get almost everybody pregnant, assuming the wife has eggs. Often, with microsurgery, we can repair the blockage, allowing them to conceive naturally. When I've been talking to audiences like this, and I ask how many couples would rather conceive in a petri dish versus in bed, I've never yet had a couple who said they prefer to conceive in a petri dish. So typically, if it's a potentially repairable blockage, we'll try and repair it. If it's not a repairable blockage, in almost every case where it's an obstruction, obstructive azoospermia, we can suck sperm out of a little bit of duct that's present, or as a last resort, easily get it from the testicle. The other cause of a zero sperm count is non-obstructive azoospermia. That's a problem with production. So zero sperm counts are always going to be due to one of two things. Either it's a lack of production or it's an obstruction. And the first thing we need to do is determine what the cause is. And I'm going to go through how we decide that. First of all, as you know, a couple times, when a couple couldn't have children, it was always blamed on the woman. We now know that in about a third of the cases, it's a female factor, a pure female factor. In about a third of the cases, it's a pure problem with the male. And the other third, it's a combination of the two. So that means that the male is contributing to a fertility issue in at least half of all cases of couples who can't have children. What's this? Very sensitive. Okay. Well, I'll just go to this. And what we can do by working with the urologist who specializes in this area is we can take couples who originally were only candidates for donor sperm or adoption, and by treating them, we can get enough sperm to appear in the testicles that we can open up the testicles and get the sperm out that way. Now, that's not a minor procedure. That literally involves splitting the testicle in half like an egg under a general anesthesia, searching through all 400 to 500 tubules in each testicle, and in more than half of these cases, we can find enough sperm to inject into the eggs. And this was the major advance that Dr. Schlegel developed. Finally, in at least half of cases of non-obstructive azoospermia, by treating the male, sometimes with microsurgery, there's no blockage, so we don't fix the blockage, but some of these men with non-obstructive azoospermia have other conditions. They may have a deficiency of the male hormone testosterone, which is responsible for men's sex drive, energy level, muscle strength, bone health, and if they have a low testosterone and their pituitary hormones, which control sperm production in men and ovaries, production of eggs, FSH, follicle stimulating hormone, and LH, if they're not too high, we can give them drugs like Clomid, or if a man is overweight, we give them something called Arimidex. Sometimes we give them together. We can sometimes induce enough production that sperm will now appear in the ejaculate, so we don't have to split open the testis. So we can upgrade them for surgical sperm retrieval. Doing IVF with ICSI, we can maybe get a few hundred or a few thousand sperm in the ejaculate, but we don't have to open the testicles up anymore and use those sperm. So upgrade them to surgical sperm retrieval from no chance for anything, from surgical sperm retrieval to the appearance of sperm in the ejaculate, and if they're very fortunate, we can even, in some couples, allow them to do IUI, and in some cases, natural conception. If a man has non-obstructive azoospermia because he's born with a deficiency of the brain hormones, that's called hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. Most of the men we see have hypergonadotropic hypogonadism. We know they have a production problem because they have a high level of follicle-stimulating, FSH. That's the hormone that becomes elevated when a woman is near menopause and we know she's not making eggs anymore. If a man isn't making sperm anymore, we can tell because his FSH will be elevated. But some men are born with a condition, if they don't have a sense of smell, it's called Kallmann syndrome, called hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. They have low testosterone and a very low undetectable LH and FSH. And those men, we can treat with injections to replace the missing hormones, and a majority of them are able to conceive absolutely naturally. So you don't want to miss that diagnosis. On the other hand, if they have a very high FSH and they have small soft testes, we know it's non-obstructive. Those men, we can treat some of them with Clomid or Arimidex, and if they have varicose veins in the scrotum, which is not the main cause of their problem, but it creates an environment that's not conducive to sperm production because it heats up the testicle. 50% of men that have clinically significant varicoceles, meaning ones that you could feel, and they have a non-obstructive, zero sperm count, if we repair the varicoceles, and often I also give them Clomid and Arimidex, that combination, half of them will be able to do IVF with ejaculated sperm instead of splitting open the testicles. And some of them actually will get good enough that we could do intrauterine insemination. Very, very rarely it'll allow them to conceive naturally. So we can upgrade the status of the male and downgrade the level of invasiveness and the level of reproductive technologies that are required to achieve a pregnancy. So the first thing we have to do is find out what it is. Is it obstructive? Is it non-obstructive? Okay, and I can usually tell, I'd say in 90% of the couples I see, just by talking to the couple and then doing a careful physical examination, I can determine is it obstructive or is it non-obstructive. If the patient, for example, has a history of having a child when he was younger, and then he had hernia repairs, and now he has a zero sperm count, and on examining him, he's got normal-sized testicles, and I can feel swollen ducts. That's one of the nice things about my specialty compared to the reproductive endocrinologist. In the men, everything is hanging out in the breeze. And with a warm, relaxed scrotum, I can tell what's going on just by examining, by talking to the man and examining him. There's an old adage in medicine. If you want to know what's wrong with the patient, ask him, and then listen. They'll usually tell you. And then by examining him, I feel the testicles are large, I feel the ducts are swollen, and then just for confirmation, I'll get a blood test, normal testosterone, normal LH, normal FSH. Those are the ones I'm thrilled about. I can fix that. If, on the other hand, I examine him, normal testicles, normal FSH, zero sperm count, no history of getting anyone pregnant ever, and there's no vas deferens. The sperm duct is missing. That's congenital bilateral aphthous of the vas deferens. When I started out in this field, it was the worst diagnosis. All we could do was donor sperm or adoption. Now it's the best diagnosis. we have a 90% pregnancy rate after at least three IVF tries in men with congenital absence of the vas deferens. Those men need to get tested for the cystic fibrosis mutation. Almost all of them have it. If they do, we need to check their wives. There's a 3% incidence of wives who are of Northern European background of having that. If they both have it, then when we do the IVF, we need to check the embryos before putting them back in to make sure that the baby they have doesn't have the more serious condition of cystic fibrosis. So were you fertile before you had the hernia operations, or maybe when you were a kid you had an undescended testicle on one side and it's a small rotten testicle, the other side's a normal testicle, but you had a hernia operation there, or you had a hydrocele operation when you were a kid on both sides or on the one good testicle. So history is important. If they have a low testosterone, most men will report a decrease in their desire for their wives. So libido is a crude reflection of testosterone levels, although I don't count on that alone. A lot of the young couples I see, if you have a very young, attractive wife, that can compensate for low testosterone, so I still will do the blood tests. Medications, sulfasalazine, which used to and still is commonly used for the inflammatory bowel diseases, can have a negative effect on fertility, and some of the drugs that are used for hypertension, calcium channel blockers such as verapamil, can prevent fertilization, but they don't present with zero sperm counts. Drugs and alcohol is a very rare problem in this community. History of testis pain and swelling. If a child had a history of recurrent urinary tract infections, and then when he was older, after puberty, he got sudden swelling and pain in the testicles, he could have a blockage of the epididymis from epididymitis, which is not at all uncommon. And as I mentioned, a history of hernia repairs, a history of undescended testicle operations, a history of hydroceles, and brother's fertility history. Some of the conditions that are genetic are common in the family, and they may have a brother who said, well, he's never had children. So it's important to do a good history, and then a careful physical examination. Wow, this is very sensitive. The most important part of the physical examination is, first, a good exam is not just having a man dropping his shorts and feeling his testicles. You have to look at, is he fully masculinized? Does he have a normal body habitus? Does he have breast enlargement indicating not enough testosterone and too much estrogen? Does he have long arms and wide hips, Klinefelter syndrome, an extra X chromosome? You can tell just by looking at the man. If you measure the distance of the fingertip to fingertip in a man with inadequate testosterone at the time of puberty, it'll be more than 5 centimeters greater than his height. Or if you measure the distance from his feet to his pubic bone, it'll be more than 5 centimeters greater than the distance from his pubic bone to the top of his head. That's because you need testosterone in men, estrogen in women, for the epiphyses, the bone plates, to close. If you don't have it, the bone plates don't close. So actually, the tallest men are those who go through puberty the latest. So these men tend to be tall, they have somewhat wide hips, they have a little gynecomastia, and they're not fully masculinized. Klinefelter syndrome can look like that. If we see that in a man with a zero sperm count, you're always going to get a blood test and make sure they have the right number of chromosomes. That's called a karyotype. In men, it should be 46, an X and a Y. The Y is the male chromosome. The most important aid in examining a man is not an ultrasound or a CT scan or an MRI. It's a heating pad. I don't know how many of you have ever watched the Seinfeld show. There's an episode where George comes out of a cold swimming pool and everything's all shriveled up. And a young lady, just as he's changing out of his wet bathing suit, accidentally opens the door where he's changing and looks down and sees he's all shriveled up, and she starts to giggle. And he wonders, why is she giggling? He looks down and sees he's shriveled up and says, I was in the pool. I teach the Cornell medical students the course in how to examine men. I show that video clip at the beginning to emphasize the importance of a warm, relaxed scrotum. If you have a tight scrotum because it's cold, or you have a tight scrotum because you're anxious, you're not going to be able to pick up enlarged ducts. You're not going to be able to pick up varicoceles. So a heating pad we have put on the scrotum for 5 minutes before examining the man. And then, as I said, you don't just have him drop the shorts. You have him take everything off, stand before you and look to see, are they fully masculinized? Do they have breast enlargement? And then, of course, you want to make sure the opening at the end of the penis is coming out in the right place, that they don't have something called hypospadias. Are there varicose veins? In some men, no matter what you do, you can't do a good examination of the cord, and you can't tell if they're varicocele. Those men we will send for an ultrasound. Now, varicose veins in the scrotum are exactly the same condition as varicose veins in the legs. A lot of women get them after childbirth from the pressure of the baby on the big veins. If you get them back here, they're called hemorrhoids. They're veins where the valves are not competent, so blood goes backwards, and the vein becomes enlarged and thick-walled. Obviously, if it occurs in the legs or occurs back here, it doesn't have an effect on the testis. When your testis, however, is surrounded by enlarged, thick-walled veins, it heats them up. Men's testicles are hanging outside of the body because they produce sperm at a temperature about 3 degrees centigrade cooler than your body temperature. That's why we tell you don't take long hot baths. Don't go in hot mikvahs. You want to keep your testicles cool. And if you're surrounded with varicose veins, they're constantly heated up. If you improve the environment for sperm production by doing microsurgery, a fairly minor outpatient procedure to eliminate that, it improves the environment for sperm production. And even when the primary cause is, say, genetic, it'll improve the environment in half of patients enough that enough sperm will now appear in the semen to make them candidates for IVF using semen instead of having to open up the testicles. And then finally, you want to see, are the testicles normal? You can often tell, or most of the time I can tell, is it blockage or not, just by feeling the testicles. Small, soft testicles, I know right away it's non-obstructive adipospermia. Large, firm testicles with a swollen duct behind it or missing ducts, I know right away that it's obstructive. And then we can do some tests to confirm or deny that. Semen analysis. We almost never do a single analysis. This is a Cornell medical student, a proven donor, who gave a specimen every 2 weeks for 2 years. And you'll see that just before final, some of his tests were almost zero. And then after he passed, it went back to normal. So we almost never rely on a single analysis, except in certain circumstances. If you don't feel a VAS, then you don't need to do another analysis. You know it's going to be zero. If they've had multiple postcoital tests showing no sperm, and the analysis is done in a lab where the specimen is centrifuged and we examine the pellet. So it's got to be done, if you're going to do an analysis and you got permission from your rabbi to do that, it should be done at the best possible fertility lab where they spin it down. In our lab, we go one step further. In men with a zero sperm count, we do something called an extended sperm search. Actually, this was first pointed out in labs in Israel, in that almost 10 to 15% of men that have a zero sperm count in the ordinary analysis with the centrifuge pellet, nothing found in the pellet, if we search 800 slides, which takes several hours, we can find occasional sperm. Not enough usually to do IVF, but if we find even one in the semen analysis, that means we almost certainly are going to be able to either find sperm in the testicle adequate used for IVF, or by treating a man, induce an increase in the number of sperm to allow IVF with ICSI without opening up the testicles. So we do something called an extended sperm search. And then the blood tests are simply confirmatory, the ones I've mentioned to you. Go back. It's not going back. Okay. Just want to go back one. There we go. Okay, these are the blood tests, and these are usually just to confirm what I already know from examining the man. If he has obstruction, he's going to have normal levels of LH, FSH, and testosterone. If he has that condition called Kallmann syndrome, where his body habitus looks like a Klinefelter's, except instead of a high FSH, he has a low FSH, and the testicles are small, those men have a high FSH, and a high LH and a very low testosterone. If they have a very low everything, that's Kallmann syndrome, and that we can treat and get you pregnant naturally. So you don't want to miss that. The volume of the testis, 25 mLs, is normal. Non-obstructive, a somewhat elevated LH. FSH should be under 8. It's 21. A lowish testosterone. A normal prolactin. Some men have hyperprolactinemia from a prolactinoma in the brain, also very treatable, which causes a low testosterone, but usually not a zero sperm count. And small testes, they should be 15 to 30, 10 cc's, and soft. Soft, if you make a tight fist, this is called your penile eminence. A normal testicle will feel like that. If you open your fist up, it gets kind of soft and mushy. That's what the non-obstructive azoospermia patient will feel like. So the blood test generally confirm usually what I already know just from the good history and the physical examination. Okay, the next one, yeah. So with this evaluation, we can find out what's going on in a vast majority of men. And even those that where we can't specifically treat it, like Klinefelter's poor production issues, if we can't treat it, we can actually usually find sperm in the testicles in more than half of the patients. The next slide. So azoospermia, which is the focus of this talk, the first goal is it obstruction? And here's a biopsy. We used to do biopsies often in these men. Now we don't have to most of the time. I can tell by the examination. I can tell by the high FSH. I can tell by the zero sperm count. So, and if they have a normal FSH and they have big testes and swollen ducts, you're going to see a normal biopsy. And these little dots here are lots of sperm inside the tubule. Non-obstructive azoospermia, all you see are the supporting cells. They're called Sertoli cells, which is why the other name for the most severe form of it, called germ cell aplasia or Sertoli cell only, is only lined by the Sertoli cells. That's a lack of production. Sometimes I need to do a biopsy to know which it is. Sometimes the testis size is sort of not terrible and not great. The ducts maybe are a little bit swollen. The FSH is basically normal. Then maybe we need to do a biopsy to make the decision. But even when we do a biopsy for diagnostic reasons, it should never be just for diagnostic reasons. If we find any sperm at the time of the biopsy, the place where you have the biopsy should be prepared to freeze and preserve those sperm. That should never be wasted, because these men usually have very few sperm. The next slide. The other thing we do if we're not sure is we'll take a blood test. There's something called anti-sperm antibodies. Normally sperm are never seen by a man's immune system. They're hidden inside the testicle. There's something called the blood testis barrier, very similar to something you may have heard of called the blood-brain barrier, which prevents certain things from getting in and out of the brain. Sperm are never exposed to a man's immune system. If they have a blockage because they had a hernia operation or they had an epididymitis, a urinary tract infections when they're younger, the sperm are being absorbed into the man's body, which is exactly what happens after vasectomies in men. 70% of men, if they've had a vasectomy because they don't want any more children, they're absorbing sperm, they're still making them. But your body looks at a sperm, which unlike all the other cells in your body has only 23 chromosomes. Unlike any other cell, male or female, it's the only one that has a tail and swims. Your body's immune system, it sees a sperm. It says, what is this? It's a foreign body, and it attacks it. So most men who have obstructions have anti-sperm antibodies. So if we're not sure, is it blockage or not, get a blood test, simple blood test, and see if they have antibodies. If they have high levels of antibodies, you can't make antibodies against sperm if you're not making sperm. Very simple test. Anti-sperm antibodies positive, you don't need a biopsy to know it's a blockage. You can go right away to an operation to fix the blockage, hopefully, and if it can't be fixed, to at least retrieve the sperm. Next slide. These are the many procedures in which I've encountered accidental blockage of the vas. By far the most common is hernia repair. Scrotal surgery such as hydrocele repair, which is repair of a bag of water, commonly done in infants, and the ducts in infants are tiny, incredibly easy to injure the ducts. Next slide. With a blockage, if it's in the vas from a hernia repair, we have over 95% success rate in getting normal production, normal sperm counts back. So that would be the first goal, especially in this audience where you want to have as many children as possible. If you want 10 children, you don't want to go through 30 IVFs. Aside from breaking the bank, it's putting the wife through a lot. She'll turn into a pincushion. If we can fix it, the goal is to fix it. This shows fixing a blockage of the vas from hernia operations, and if it's from the epididymis, we do the same thing. Next slide. And this just shows my results with microsurgical repair. We get sperm back in the ejaculate in a large percentage of patients, over 99%. They don't all get pregnant because the sperm, when it's been blocked, the ducts don't always function normally. So some of these couples will need to do IUI or even IVF, but they could do IVF with the sperm that's ejaculated now if they have a reconstruction and get sperm back, but they're not getting pregnant naturally. Next slide. And I'm not going to go over the cost, but it's far more cost effective. This is Dr. Schlegel's work showing the cost of getting a baby, if you fix the blockage, is significantly less per delivery, and this was in Europe also, than the cost of doing it with sperm retrieval and IVF. And that's especially true if you want more than one child. Next slide. This shows me fixing a blockage of the epididymis. This is a duct that's 200 microns in diameter. That's twice the size of one of the hairs on your head. So I'm looking under a high-powered microscope. I open up the tubule. I connect the vas to the epididymis. Before I do that, I suck sperm out, because unlike the vasovasostomy, the vasoepididymostomy has an 80% success rate. If it's one of the 20% that fail, at least we've got sperm that we retrieve, and we could use that for IVF if the surgery doesn't work. Next slide. And this shows we get huge numbers of sperm in minimal block. We get 82 million sperm on average. And the live delivery rate, just the very first IVF try, is 67% because the sperm are normal and the wives are normal. Next slide. Some men have nothing coming out when they ejaculate because they have neurological conditions, and that's causing the azoospermia. Some men are unable to ejaculate. Sometimes it's for emotional reasons, sometimes for neurologic. We can make them ejaculate by putting them to sleep and then putting a probe in the rectum, which stimulates the nerves of ejaculation where they run along the prostate, and we can electro-ejaculate men. Sometimes it's from diabetes, sometimes from spinal cord injuries. In a majority of men, we can get sperm 90%. That can be used for IUI if it's good quality, and can always be used for IVF. Next, varicoceles. Most commonly the cause of infertility, where the man has reasonable sperm counts, maybe slightly low count, low motility, low morphology, poor DNA integrity. And when they have that, this will usually allow conception either with IUI or naturally. But in men with non-obstructive azoospermia, it's not the primary cause. It's usually genetic. One thing I didn't, that slide got skipped, but in men that have azoospermia, genetic tests are indicated. If it's because you think there's an absence of the vas, the only genetic test that needs to be done is cystic fibrosis. If they have non-obstructive azoospermia, however, then there are two tests you need to do. A karyotype, because the most common genetic abnormality, and it's 1 in 600 men, is Klinefelter's, the extra X chromosome. And even in those men, at Cornell, we can now find sperm and get pregnancies. We can find sperm in 60% of those men enough to inject into the wife's eggs. And interestingly, none of the kids of these patients end up having Klinefelter's. The only sperm that they end up making are the normal sperm. And then the other, if they don't have Klinefelter's, if they have a normal karyotype, you want to see if they're missing a little piece of the Y chromosome. It's called a micro-Y deletion. So non-obstructive azoospermia, there are two genetic tests they need, a karyotype, and if the karyotype shows Klinefelter's, that's all they need. If the karyotype is normal, they need to get a test for micro-Y deletion, just blood tests. And if they have obstructive azoospermia due to absence or possible absence of part of the ducts, you want to get a cystic fibrosis mutation test. Next slide. In men, all men, there's about a 15% incidence of varicoceles. In men who never got anybody pregnant, it's about 35%. It's rarely a cause of azoospermia, except there are some men with giant varicoceles that fill the whole scrotum. Those men can have a zero sperm count. Those are the men that, when you're a parent, they go on to achieve pregnancy naturally. The very first varicocele operation done for infertility in 1955 was a man with a zero sperm count, a giant varicocele, fixed it and went on to conceive naturally way before IVF. But it's the most common cause of couples who are able to get pregnant when they were younger, but because varicocele causes a steady, inexorable deterioration, if it's not fixed, it's the most common cause of secondary infertility, where you had a pregnancy. Next slide. It causes a decline in fertility, and men with zero sperm counts may benefit. And men who have varicoceles may also benefit because it causes a low testosterone. Next. I'm not going to go into this too much, but in men who have reasonable sperm counts, not zero, the bigger the varicocele, the bigger the improvement. So big varicoceles cause more impairment, but the bigger the varicocele, the bigger the improvement. Next. It does also increase testosterone levels. That's the other function of the testis. That's a long-term health issue. We're repairing varicoceles in older men who have completed their families because they have low testosterone, and instead of giving them testosterone replacement, which you never want to give in a man who's trying to have children. One thing I want you all to remember, testosterone is a contraceptive for men. It suppresses sperm production. So if you repair the varicocele, they can increase their own testosterone production. And that's probably preferable to taking daily testosterone replacement. There is no testosterone pill that you can take. Testosterone can only be given by shots, patches, gels. Next slide. I'm not going to go into the technique. This is a technique I introduced in the mid-80s. I've done almost 4,000 now. No one's lost their sperm. No one's died. The failure rate is now down to around 0.5%, and we've eliminated hydrocele. I've had one infection. Next slide. So how a varicocele is important in terms of reducing the failure rate and the complication rate. And if you look at couples who have a male factor and it's due to a varicocele, and that's not the azoospermia patients we're talking about here, but if you follow them for a year, 17% of the wives are pregnant. In the other half, where you repaired the varicocele, at the end of the year, 43% were pregnant, and by 2 years, 69% were pregnant, and that was without IVF. So it certainly will increase your chances of getting pregnant without resorting to the advanced forms of assisted reproduction. Next slide. One more slide, because this goes into the... go ahead. Okay, go back one if you can. What we found is, and there are now at least a half a dozen studies here and from Europe, that show if you fix a varicocele, not only does it improve your chances of getting pregnant naturally, but if you have to resort to IVF, it significantly decreases the fragmentation of DNA in the sperm and increases the success of IVF ICSI. There's a much lower spontaneous miscarriage rate in men who have the varicocele fixed and a much higher success rate with IVF. The success rates with IVF are doubled if you repair the varicocele before doing the IVF. Next slide. In men with zero sperm counts, these are the ones we have here, if you repair their varicocele and they don't have a deletion of the Y chromosome as the cause and they don't have Klinefelters, half of them will get enough sperm back in the semen to allow IVF without having to split open the testicles. And repairing the varicocele is a much simpler, less invasive operation than testicular sperm extraction. Next slide. And as I mentioned, testosterone goes up as well, which is a long-term health benefit. Next slide. Who are the best candidates for that? Boys with big varicoceles, much easier to prevent future infertility and low testosterone than to treat it after it's occurred. Men with non-obstructive azoospermia, which is what we're talking about here, where you can actually feel the varicoceles. It's very controversial whether it's worth doing ones that only show up on an ultrasound. I generally don't do that. If I can't feel it, even with a relaxed scrotum in a warm room, I don't prepare it. Next slide. It's cost effective. Next slide. And then, as I said, you can upgrade patients from nothing to something with hormonal treatment. If they have Coleman syndrome, as I've mentioned, where they're missing the hormones, most of them they can get pregnant naturally. It can increase the chances of sperm appearing in the ejaculate. It may improve the success rates. But if it can upgrade you from zero to becoming a candidate for ICSI, then it's worth trying. Next slide. Klinefelters, which is non-obstructive azoospermia, some of the men who have a mosaic, where not all the cells have the extra chromosome, they may actually have sperm in their ejaculate that you could use. But with testicular sperm extraction, you can get sperm back in half of them. Next slide. In the Klinefelters at Cornell, there have now been over 100 normal children born to men, and those children, if they're males, don't have the extra X chromosome. Next slide. The most common other one is the micro Y deletion. More rarely we see translocations, ring chromosomes. If the AZF is entirely absent, then that's the only case where we can help you. So there are three parts to the Y chromosome, A, B, and C. C is the most common one, thank God, and if that's missing, we can find sperm in more than half of them. If they're missing A and B, so far there's nothing we can do. We're working on stem cells to induce production of sperm. We've been successful in mice, but it's a long way, as Steinbeck said, from mice to men. Next slide. You can skip this next slide. That's not common. So the most common deletions I mentioned, fortunately, is the C deletion. If they're missing any of these, so far there's been no success. So that's why it's important to do the micro Y. Next slide. I'm going to skip all of this. This isn't all that important. So if they are micro Y deleted and we're able to get sperm into the semen or retrieve sperm, the one thing to remember is you have a boy, the boy's going to inherit your Y chromosome and your son's going to have the same fertility problem you have. So you simply be aware of that. Next slide. Is there anything that predicts whether we can find sperm? The only thing that's predictive is the micro Y. They're missing all of A or all of B or B, A and B, no sperm. FSH, high FSH is not predictive. Tiny little testicles, 2 or 3 cc's, is not predictive. Histology, yes. If they had a biopsy in the past and it shows to totally cell only syndrome, instead of 50% success, it's still not zero, it's about 25%. But it's not probably not worth doing a biopsy unless you say, well, if it's only 25%, we're not going to bother. Previous testing outcomes, it depends on who did the testing. The way we do testing at Cornell is very different than the way it's done elsewhere. Needle biopsies and aspirations are useless in men with non-obstructive vasospermia. Those kind of procedures are only useful in men who have blockages where wherever you put the needle, you're going to get a lots of sperm. If it deleted AZFB or all of A, then there's a poor prognosis so far, nothing at all. Next. This is the Cornell experience in microdissection TESI, and basically we can find sperm in 61% of men. The fertilization rate normally is about 75% with regular IVF. It is reduced, it's 55%. Clinical pregnancy rate, if you're one of those 61% where we find sperm, is 47%. Live delivery rate, if you're one of those in whom we find sperm, is 40%. Bottom line, if we don't know if we're going to find sperm or not, and the couple go to an IVF testing cycle, the chance of walking home with a baby after one try is about 25%. So you have to realize that. Yes, there's more than a half chance we can find sperm, but the pregnancy rates are lower and the spontaneous miscarriage rates are higher because these sperm are not always 100% normal. Next. Lifestyle issues, I think, are important. That's not too much of an issue here other than you want to keep your weight good. I don't think cocaine, marijuana, alcohol, anabolic steroids, that means testosterone or anything like it, don't take that. Don't let an endocrinologist give a man testosterone because he has a low testosterone if he wants to have children in the future. You don't want to smoke. If you've had radiation or chemotherapy, that can be a cause of non-obstructive vasospermia. But we can find sperm in more than half of men after cancer treatment that have rendered them apparently sterile. Next slide. So finally, it's worth working as a team with a reproductive urologist, not a general urologist, they're not trained in this, and a reproductive endocrinologist, and also your rabbi, because there are a lot of halakhic issues that need to be discussed. Rabbi Weitzman will go over that, but in a case where it's the only way the couples are able to have a child with the man's sperm, most of those usually can ultimately be resolved. I think that's it. Next slide. Yes, this is my team. Everything here is a huge team effort. Having babies in these kind of situations is a team effort, as I said, a collaboration between your rabbis and reproductive endocrinologists and reproductive urologists. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you to Professor Goldstein. Remember, in the interest of time, we have a very short amount of time. We're not going to take questions, but Professor Goldstein's here later to take questions. I just touched on a few of the halakhot because we want to close up. We're not giving a psak halakha. And the idea of this, I think Rav Schechter, in his opening remarks, touched on that very clearly. It's not a psak, and that whether it's going to come out of a 50-minute talk being urologist, probably not, right? Probably takes him longer. And we're not going to become rabbis either, or we're not going to become poskim in this area. But just to touch on a few of the halakhot and some of the things that came up from Mark's lights. The first thing is, of course, doing a semen analysis is a halakhic question. So, as you said, you have to ask your rabbi. There are ways to do it, and there are times that it can be done. Generally, a couple come to do they come for any sort of fertility workup. The first thing they do is send for a semen analysis. I think we're clear from this talk and talks that we've had before, it's clear that there's a lot of things that we can done before you do a semen analysis. I think the physical examination is incredibly important. I think the history is incredibly important. So what did you say? Listen to the patient. Listen to the patient. That's always good if you're a rabbi as well. You should actually listen to people. So that I think is very important. And I wanted to touch on another thing that was mentioned here, is the psychogenic anejaculation. We presented a paper in Hawaii, So we presented a paper in Hawaii last year that we have today over 60 cases of men, almost all in the Haredi community, that have psychogenic anejaculation. We solved the problem by counseling and using a particular instrument called a PVS, where the paper is ready for publication.
That's a vibrator.
Right, a type of vibrator.
Special vibrator.
The real input was really the counseling, and that we really were able to solve about 70%, and of those who were able to solve, about 80% were then subsequently able to ejaculate without using the vibrator, which I think is very, very important results, with not having to have electro-ejaculation. It's actually interesting, the electro-ejaculation is already mentioned in the Gemara. The Gemara speaks about a case in which we needed to see whether a person can ejaculate, and the Gemara in Sahih Hamad speaks about placing warm bread inside the rectum in order to cause ejaculation. So that's already a classic case, and I teach you, when I teach, you know, semen analysis, I speak at it, I teach that as an important thing. The varicose seal repair is not a question halakhically. People think, does it cause serous, does it puncture the testicle? I think it's clear from the presentation that it does not, it doesn't touch a testicle. That's very important. I think when you're talking about hernia repairs, those sometimes could be questions.
Yeah.
And therefore, again, you need to look at some...
What about postcoital tests?
Right, but...
Can you talk about postcoital tests?
The postcoital tests today, I think most people are not doing them. But I think one of the few people...
Well, this
people
community doing with you, because right, at least right. It's a screening test.
So we developed a sort of a site of postcoital, which is... and I think we discussed it. We presented our paper in the Israeli Fertility Association. Is that a woman can wash herself well, they can have relations, and then we gather up the semen then, as opposed to what you were doing classically in your textbook, which is to look 24 hours later.
Right.
So that we've had, and we looked at the results of regular semen analysis to see that pretty much we're getting the same results.
Right.
We're getting less volume,
right,
but the same concentration of motility and morphology.
Right.
And the last thing, which we didn't really speak about, the actual puncture in a testicle, is of course a question of serous, of causing a man to be castrated, at least according to the halachic classification, doesn't mean that to remove the testicle, like classic sirisin, the classic eunuchs, but to puncture the testicle. And we've already written about it and presented together that since this is in order to create children, or since the damage is minimal, or since it heals, and there's a three different psakim that were given by different skin without getting into details today, so there are times in which it would be permitted. But I think what's very important to see here is that we think everybody needs to do IVF. Clearly not everybody needs to do IVF. Everybody who's got doesn't have semen ejaculate has to immediately start doing testicular biopsy. That's clearly not the case. And I think that what we're seeing, and you corroborated with your remarks, is we're seeing a lot now of more intense semen analysis that we're finding sperm in the ejaculate for a lot of these men. Small numbers, and I think sometimes we are using it for IVF even,
for
very small numbers. And that's, I think, a very promising. That we used to say, you know, you can't say that anybody is infertile, because if we look in the sperm, in the testicle, there's really no, almost all cases, maybe barring Y deletions, or there's been questions about Y deletions as well. There was a paper that said you can even find in Y deletions.
Well, it depends on the deletion.
Right.
C deletions, which is fortunately the most common, we almost always, I wouldn't say almost, half the time we can, but we've not yet found sperm in men who basically have all of the part of the Y chromosome that's responsible.
Right.
If they're missing A or B, the entire AZF region, we've not yet found sperm successfully in those men.
But in almost all the other patients, we are finding. So I think that idea of the progressive workup, and I think we also do the same. Varicose seal repair is very useful to take you to a different level. Maybe not get you pregnant, but it takes you to a different level. I think that's very important. That's part of refuah. That the idea or concept of healing fertility is not necessarily getting you pregnant naturally, but it is aiming to you to be a better patient sometimes for fertility treatment, which I think is included. Most poskim will include that in what's permitted and therefore can be done. We didn't speak about cancer patients. We didn't speak about...
I mentioned that we find sperm in 60% of the cancer patients.
So those are questions about freezing sperm, but that will speak about another question. We're not gonna open for questions because the next speakers are waiting. But we're very happy to take questions beyond the session. Thank you very much.
Okay.